Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to have some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. For some time now, we have been studying the web of debt, which is essentially the shocking truth about our money system and how we can break free from it. Over the last several months, I've been looking at how our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been, in fact, privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing us of the value of our money. The web of debt really is a thesis that unravels the deception and presents a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are all heading. But it also explores a workable alternative, one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. What we're looking at is to find financial security, our own and our nation's and the world's, and that's what we have been dedicating this show to over the last several months in a series exploring the book, The Web of Debt. The Web of Debt is a phenomenal work written by Ellen Hodgson Brown. And I have to say at the beginning that the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles related to debt. I highly recommend the book, The Web of Debt, and her website by the same name. And you can also review all of the shows in this series at the archives, www.kruufm.com, under Life and Debt, specifically Life and Debt Web. So let's start with the review from last week. We were discussing challenging corporate feudalism. And just to remind you, or for the newcomers, there is a parallel between what is happening in the financial sector and, believe it or not, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, a story written around the turn of the 19th into the 20th century, in which each of the characters actually represents a very important part of the financial crisis. The Scarecrow was in search of a brain, and he represented the unschooled farmers of the late 1800s, matching wits with the bankers, while the Tin Woodman, who had chopped out his own heart in the book, that is, reflected the plight of the working man exploited by the corporation, which was increasingly replacing the small family business competing in the quote-unquote free market. Well, in 1886, corporations were given the rights and privileges of individuals, although they lacked the morality and the conscience of live human beings. No surprise to us today. Their sole motive was profit, and in fact, it's their legal responsibility, which is the sort of single-minded devotion to self-interest that in a live human being would be considered pathological. Corporations are feudalistic organizations designed in the structure of a pyramid with an elite group at the top manipulating masses of workers below. Workers are kept marching in lockstep, passing orders down from above, out of fear of losing their jobs, their homes, and their benefits if they get out of line. At the top of the pyramid is a small group of controllers who alone know what is really going on. Critics have noted that the pyramid with an overseeing eye at the top is also the symbol of the Federal Reserve Note, the privately issued currency that became the national monetary unit in 1913. The popular grassroots movements that produced the Greenback and the Populist parties in the 1890s represented the interests of the common man over these corporate and financial oppressors. And again, as an aside, this is really what The Wizard of Oz was depicting. Populism today tends to be associated with the political left, but the word comes from the Latin word simply for the people. In the 19th century, it stood for the government of the people, by the people, for the people, proclaimed by Abraham Lincoln. According to Wikipedia, an online encyclopedia written collaboratively by volunteers, populism on the whole does not have a strong political identity as either a left-wing or right-wing movement. Populism has taken left-wing, right-wing, and even centrist forms. In recent years, conservative United States politicians have begun adopting populist rhetoric, for example, promising to get big government off your backs. And that's from Wikipedia. Although the oppressor today is seen to be big government, what the 19th century populists were trying to get off their backs was a darker, more malevolent force. They still believed that the principles set forth in the Constitution could be achieved through a democratic government of the people. They saw their antagonist rather as the private money power and the corporations it had spawned, which were threatening to take over the government unless the people intervened. Abraham Lincoln is quoted as saying, "I see in the near future a crisis approaching that unnerves me and causes me to tremble for the safety of my country. Corporations have been enthroned. An era of corruption in high places will follow, and the money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign by working upon the prejudices of the people until the wealth is aggregated in the hands of a few and the republic is destroyed." End of quote. And there's been some debate as to whether that was actually from Abraham Lincoln, but whoever said it in that era had the insight, which was prophetic. In a January 2007 article called "Who Rules America?", Professor James Petras wrote, "Today it is said 2% of the households own 80% of the world's assets. Within this small elite, a fraction embedded in financial capital owns and controls the bulk of the world's assets and organizes and facilitates further concentration of conglomerates." If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Professor Petras also observed, "Within the financial ruling class, political leaders come from the public and private equity banks, namely Wall Street, especially Goldman Sachs, Blackstone, the Carlyle Group, and others. They organize and fund both major parties and their electoral campaigns. They pressure, negotiate, and draw up the most comprehensive and favorable legislation on global strategies, liberalization and deregulation, and sector policies. They pressure the government to bail out bankrupt and failed speculative firms and to balance the budget by lowering social expenditures instead of raising taxes on speculative windfall profits. These private equity banks are involved in every sector of the economy, in every region of the world economy, and increasingly speculate in the conglomerates which are acquired. Much of the investment funds now in the hands of U.S. investment banks, hedge funds, and other sectors of the financial ruling class originated in profits extracted from workers in the manufacturing and service sector. End of quote. So from Professor Brown, she says it seems that the Tin Man has indeed been stripped of his heart and soul by the Witch of the East, the Wall Street bankers, just as Lincoln, the greenbackers, and the populists foresaw. Now we'll move ahead to the bankers capturing the money machine. The parallel from The Wizard of Oz was that the Wicked Witch of the East held all the munchkins in bondage for many years, making them slave for her day and night. Let's look at this concept in some detail. For Dorothy, there was no place like home. She said to the Scarecrow, "No matter how dreary and gray our homes are, we people of flesh and blood would rather live there than in any other country, be it ever so beautiful. There is no place like home." Again, this is from the book. The movie spun off of that, and it's not completely the political and economic intention that Frank Baum had been writing about. But people today wonder why Dorothy, who could have stayed and played in the Technicolor Wonderland of Oz, was so eager to get home to her dreary Kansas farm. But readers could have related to that sentiment in the 1890s when keeping the family homestead was a key political issue. Home foreclosures and evictions were occurring in record numbers at that time as they are today. A document called the Banker's Manifesto of 1892 suggested that it was all part of a deliberate plan by the bankers to disenfranchise the farmers and laborers of their homes and property. This is another document with obscure origins, but its introduction to Congress is attributed to Representative Charles Lindbergh Sr., the father of the famous aviator, who served in Congress between 1903 and 1913. This manifesto read in part, "We must proceed with caution and guard every move made, for the lower order of people are already showing signs of restless commotion." The Farmers Alliance and Knights of Labor organizations in the United States should be carefully watched by our trusted men, and we must take immediate steps to control these organizations in our interest or disrupt them. Capital, the bankers and their money, must protect itself in every possible manner through combination, which is monopoly, and legislation. The courts must be called to our aid. Debts must be collected. Bonds and mortgages foreclosed as rapidly as possible. When through the process of the law, the common people have lost their homes, they will be more tractable and easily governed through the influence of the strong arm of the government applied to a central power of imperial wealth under the control of the leading financiers. People without homes will not quarrel with their leaders. And that's the end of the passage. This was the thinking of the bankers at that time. And we wonder if it's any different today. The Farmers Alliance and Knights of Labor were the Scarecrow and Tin Woodman of Baum's tale. They were a serious force to be reckoned with back in the 1890s. They were militant and they were mad. To split these powerful opponents, the Banker's Manifesto recommended a tactic still used today. They said, "While our principal men are engaged in forming an imperialism of the world, the people must be kept in a state of political antagonism. By dividing voters, we can get them to expend their energies in fighting over questions of no importance to us. Thus, by discreet action, we can secure all that has been so generously planned and successfully accomplished. This is such a pertinent quote, I'm going to read it again. While our principal men are engaged in forming an imperialism of the world, the people must be kept in a state of political antagonism. By thus dividing voters, we can get them to expend their energies in fighting over questions of no importance to us. Thus, by discreet action, we can secure all that has been so generously planned and successfully accomplished. End of quote. The voters then, as now, were kept pacified with the right to vote for one or two or three candidates, all manipulated by the same puppeteers. As Indian author Arundhati Roy would complain of the election process a century later, it's not a real choice, it's an apparent choice, like choosing a brand of detergent. Whether you buy Ivory Snow or Tide, they're both owned by Procter & Gamble. Those in positions of real power, the bankers, the CEOs, are not vulnerable to the vote, and in any case, they fund both sides. And a contemporary proof of this is, as I said in the past, what came out in the documentary movie Inside Job, which I highly recommend that you take time to watch, because it shows how white-collar criminals are, in ultimate effect, completely not only above the law, but embraced by it, to the disadvantage of everyone else in the system. It was this sort of disillusionment that we see in the political process that prompted Howard Zinn, professor emeritus in Boston University's history department, to state way back in 2001, "For progressive movements, the future does not lie with electoral politics. It lies in street warfare, protest movements and demonstrations, civil disobedience, strikes and boycotts, using all of the power consumers and workers have in direct action against the government and corporations." End of quote. Going back in history, the tradition of street protests dates back to 1894, when Coxey's army marched from Ohio to Washington, D.C., to petition Congress to revive the greenback system. Just to refresh your memory, the greenback system is the government is making the money, and there are no central banks like the Federal Reserve to borrow it from and pay interest on, which is repaid then through taxes. Well, let's look at Coxey. In striking contrast to the ragtag army he led, General Jacob S. Coxey, general in quotes, of course, was a wealthy populist who owned a sand quarry, bred horses, and wore hand-tailored suits. He was in it for the cause, one to which he was so committed that he named his son Legal Tender. Like Frank Baum, Coxey was a follower of the new Theosophical movement that was all the rage in the 1890s. He said his monetary solution had come to him fully formed in a dream. He didn't just dream it, but took it right to the Capitol steps in the sort of can-do spirit that would come to characterize the populist movement. He called his protest march a petition in boots. When Coxey's army, some 500 strong, entered Washington, D.C., and marched down Pennsylvania Avenue, the perceived threat was so great that 1,500 U.S. soldiers were stationed to resist them. Coxey attempted to deliver his speech on the Capitol steps, but was prevented by the police. He wound up spending 20 days in jail for trespassing on the grass and displaying a prohibited banner, actually a 3-inch by 2-inch lapel pin. His prepared speech was later entered into the congressional record by his supporters. It was quite eloquent and moving, revealing the extremity and the despair of a people who had become progressively poorer as the bankers had become richer. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So this is what General Coxey said. "Up these steps, the lobbyists of trusts and corporations have passed unchallenged on their way to committee rooms, access to which we, the representatives of the toiling wealth producers have been denied. We stand here today in behalf of millions of toilers whose petitions have been buried in committee rooms, whose prayers have been unresponded to, and whose opportunities for honest, remunerative, productive labor have been taken from them by unjust legislation, which protect idlers, speculators, and gamblers. We come to remind the Congress here assembled of the declaration of a United States Senator that for a quarter of a century the rich have been growing richer, the poor poorer, and that by the close of the present century, the middle class will have disappeared as the struggle for existence becomes fierce and relentless. We have come here through toil and weary marches, through storms and tempests, over mountains and amid the trials of poverty and distress, to lay our grievances at the doors of our national legislature. We are here to petition for legislation which will furnish employment for every man able and willing to work, for legislation which will bring universal prosperity and emancipate our beloved country from financial bondage to the descendants of King George. We are engaged in a bitter and cruel war with the enemies of all mankind, a war with hunger, wretchedness, and despair, and we ask Congress to heed our petitions and issue for the nation's good a sufficient volume of the same kind of money which carried the country through one awful war and saved the life of the nation. End of quote. Coxey proposed two bills, one primarily to help farmers, the other to help urban laborers. Under his Good Roads Bill, $500 million would be issued in legal tender notes or greenbacks to construct the roads particularly needed in rural America. For city dwellers, Coxey proposed a non-interest bearing bonds bill. It would authorize state and local governments to issue non-interest-bearing bonds that would be used to borrow legal tender notes from the federal treasury. The monies raised by these transactions would be used for public projects such as building libraries, schools, utility plants, and marketplaces. Coxey was thus proposing something quite new and revolutionary. The government would determine the projects it wants to carry out, then issue the money to pay for them. The country did not need to be limited by the money it already had, money based on gold the bankers controlled. Money was simply a receipt for labor and materials, which the government could and should issue itself. If the labor and materials were available and people wanted the work done, they could all get together and trade using paper receipts of their own design. It was a manifestation of the theosophical tenet that you could achieve your dreams simply by realizing them, that is, by making them real. You could realize the abundance you already had just by bringing its potential into manifestation. Well, when Coxey's army failed to move Congress, other industrial armies were inspired to take up the cause. There were over 40 in all. Some 1,200 protesters managed to overcome the resistance of the railroad companies, federal marshals, the U.S. Army, and judicial injunctions to arrive in Washington in 1894. One group called Hogan's Army began its march in Montana, too far to walk to the Capitol, so the protesters commandeered a train. When the U.S. Marshal and his men attempted to stop them, a gun battle resulted in several injuries and one death. The U.S. Army finally seized the train. Hogan's heroes were arrested, and Hogan spent 6 months in jail. Over the next century, progressively larger street protests were built on the precedent Coxey's army had established. In 1913, women suffragists sponsored a national march on Washington that had federal support. In 1932, approximately 20,000 starving, unemployed World War I veterans and their families marched for the bonus bill drafted by Congressman Wright Patman. The bill sought to give veterans the present value of their bonuses, which had been issued in 1924, but were not to be paid until 1945. When their demands were turned down by President Hoover, the bonus army camped out in shanty towns called Hoovervilles across the Potomac. The camps did not disband until Hoover sent in troops led by his brightest and best, Douglas MacArthur, Dwight Eisenhower, and George Patton. The veterans were routed and their camps set ablaze, killing 3 and injuring about 1,000. On April 25, 2004, in the largest ever protest march recorded up to that date, more than 1 million people filled the Capitol petitioning for women's rights. The day before that, thousands marched to protest World Bank IMF policies. We see that there has been historically these attempts to influence Congress at the grassroots level. Well, when the Greenback Party failed to achieve monetary reform, many of its members joined the Populist Party. The populists felt that they, rather than the older political parties, represented the true American principles of the Founding Fathers, and one fundamental principle they felt had been lost was that creating the national currency was the sole prerogative of the government. The populists also favored retrieving for the Commonwealth certain public assets that had been usurped by private corporate cartels, including the banks, railroads, telephone and telegraph, and the public lands that had been given away to private railroad and other corporate monopolies. The populist movement of the 1890s represented the last serious challenge to the bankers' monopoly over the right to create the nation's money. In 1895, popular interest in the money question was aroused by a book called Coins Financial School, which quickly sold 1 million copies. Its author, Chicago journalist William Hope Harvey, expressed the issues in a way that common people could understand. He maintained that the attempt to restrict the coinage of silver was a conspiracy designed to enrich the London-controlled Eastern financiers at the expense of farmers and debtors. He called England a power that can dictate the money of the world and thereby create world misery. The crime of 73, this is 1873, the act limiting the free coinage of silver, took away the silver money of the people and replaced it with gold of the British bankers. Harvey observed that the United States was then paying England $200 million in gold annually just in interest on its bonds, and that the devaluation of silver as against gold had caused Americans to lose the equivalent of $400 million in property to meet this interest burden. Coins Financial School set the stage for William Jennings Bryan's Cross of Gold speech, which met with a receptive audience, and Harvey became an important economic advisor to Bryan in his bid for the presidency. In 1896, populist supporters and civil rights dominated the Democratic Convention. All they needed, said one reporter, was a Moses. Bryan appeared to fill the bill, but William McKinley, his Republican opponent, had the support of big business, including a $250,000 contribution from the Rockefeller Standard Oil Company, then an enormous sum. The election was close, but McKinley won, and he won again in 1900. Come back next week and we will continue our journey out of the web of debt. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. Speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt manageable life.